Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is episode 77 for Tuesday, November 23rd, 2010. I'm David O'Brien.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm Ben Snitkoff.
As usual, we have three great stories for you, including Google Contacts, Facebook wants them, a teenager in New York sells white iPhones, and if Google manipulated search results. So, diving right into it, we have our first story about Google Contacts. This is actually an older story that first cropped up in the beginning of the month, but it seems to keep going on. Facebook, who gives users an option to import their contacts from Gmail accounts, this feature basically allows Facebook users to see which of their Google contacts are using Facebook and allow those users to sort of contact their Gmail contacts through Facebook easier. So basically it's a way to link up easier with people in Facebook. Facebook also has similar options for Yahoo mail accounts and Windows Live Hotmail accounts as well. But apparently Facebook does not allow Google and some of these other web service providers to do the same thing with Facebook accounts. That is, if you logged into Gmail, you can't provide your credentials to your Facebook account and then see who you could find through your Facebook account and what ways you might be able to contact them. For instance, if they have like an easy Facebook messaging service, like one that was announced just the other week, or something along those lines, you couldn't do that through Google's interface. So, as it turns out, Google was not very happy about this. This has apparently been the norm for a long time, and Facebook has had access to Google Contacts through the Google API for a while as well. It's basically allowed all these users to import their Gmail contacts really easily, but Google is no longer very happy about this, and they've decided that since there's no easy way for a Google account holder to get Facebook contacts, sort of like a reciprocal relationship between Facebook contacts and Google contacts, they've decided that they don't want to allow Facebook users to import their contacts, at least not in an automated fashion, through their Facebook accounts. And the way that they did this was just by changing a couple of terms in their API terms of service. And now the terms of service reads that Google supports data portability, and by accessing content through the Contacts Data API or Portable Contacts API, you are agreeing to enable your users to export their contacts data to other services or applications of their choice in a way that's substantially as fast and as easy as exporting such data from Google Contacts. So basically they're saying if you are going to import the Google contact data, you also have to allow us to access your data in your own proprietary API. And for Facebook, this would mean that Google would need to be able to access, or at least have equal access to the Facebook account information. And that's what happened at the beginning of the month, but the story has gone on. Apparently Facebook answered back with finding a method of routing around the new terms of service prohibition. And instead of automating the import process now, or at least there was a way to do this manually. And so Google was still allowing its users to download their contacts in a file. And what Facebook was doing was they were trying to automate a way, or make it easy at least, for users, Facebook users, to download their contact information into a file and then upload it to Facebook. So instead of doing it automatically by providing your Google contacts to Facebook, instead you just do it through a file that you download. And Google again responded back, and this time it was redirecting users who were attempting to manually download the file and import that file into Facebook with, it would redirect them to a public service announcement page that says, "Trap my contacts now," and it had a couple of other little quips about Facebook saying, "You're essentially locking up your contact data about your friends. Once you import this data to Facebook, it will never get out. Are you sure you want to do this?" And it gives users another chance to opt out before actually importing the file into Facebook. So, of course, this has gotten a lot of attention over the last month or so. Mike Arrington is signaling that this is the beginning, or that this signals the beginning of the data protectionism era, an era where data portability is decreased between platform APIs and socially oriented web services like Google and Facebook and others. This is one of those stories that it's somewhat hard to pin down legal perspectives on, but I think that there are some interesting implications between what users' rights might be and what the rights might be between web service operators like Google and Facebook. So what do you guys think about this story?
Well, I mean, it's very much in line with what Facebook's wanting to do in terms of becoming a walled garden and the only garden. They also had a little run-in with Twitter a couple months ago when Twitter tried adding functionality that let you find out who your who out of your Facebook friends was also in Twitter. This functionality was implemented for a little bit, then Facebook disabled it, and it hasn't been enabled since.
Yeah, and that seems to line up with what Mike Arrington says, and he says this is going to be the beginning of when companies start protecting their data and holding it close, no longer opening up APIs for contacts to be easily, you know, imported between services. But what does that mean for users? I mean, are users essentially prohibited from doing this, or do we have any ownership over our contact information?
You have exactly how much ownership over the contact information as whatever the user agreement says you have.
That's a very dystopian view of it, Ben.
I mean, do we want to create some new privacy, some new right in this data? It doesn't fall under copyright because it's a list. It doesn't fall under trademark or patent because it's neither trademarkable nor patentable. The only thing it would fall under intellectual property that I can think of, at least, is trade secret. And I'm sorry, but if you're disclosing it to Google, unless there's some sort of secrecy agreement, I don't think... I mean, is somebody going to sue Google for disclosing or not allowing them to disclose their trade secrets? I don't understand how that would even work.
Right, but to play devil's advocate a little bit, shouldn't users have some sort of right in their, like, who their friends are? I mean, that's not something a corporation should control. If they say, we want to take away the right of a corporation to know who my friends are or give it to a different corporation or move it around, they should be able to freely move it. Like, corporations should make that happen. They shouldn't be tied into Facebook or Google or any service, right?
And when I first started using iTunes, I would have liked it if I could take my, you know, the songs I bought on iTunes and, you know, freely move them about. But at the time, I had agreed to the digital rights management that iTunes was slapping on every song that they were selling.
Does anyone else have any problems with the fact that you can import, or at least you used to be able to import your contact information, which essentially amounts to at least email addresses, I think, or entries in your Google account of other people, people that you've contacted, and occasionally that includes addresses and telephone numbers. I know that I personally sync up my phone with my Google contacts to keep that information not only like relevant but also up to date. Does anyone have any problems with somebody being able to upload that information about you to a web service provider like Facebook from a Google, you know, a Google contact?
So let me just make sure I understand this. Say I'm not on Facebook, and you're saying that I'm one of your contacts, and you're logging into Facebook and uploading your Google address book, and it has my address, and Facebook gets that, right? Is that the scenario
yes.
you're positing?
Yes, exactly. No different than what's already happening. But somebody else is providing information that might not necessarily be private in the sense that it's protected by some type of privacy law, but it's still personal information, and that might be information that Facebook, let's say if you already had a Facebook account, that Facebook might not have already had about you from when you originally filled out your profile. Or maybe they, if you didn't have an account, in that case, Facebook now has several different ways to reach out to you, or they have personal information that they might be able to do things with in the future.
Well, do I have any right in an email address that I give to you?
No, I don't think you do. I think that there isn't really an easy legal answer to this. Well, actually, there is probably an easy legal answer, and the fact is that you really don't, as we sort of already discussed here, you really don't have any legal rights to that type of information. But it just strikes me as odd that Google and Facebook are really interested in this data, and it's not just about letting you import your contacts in for the sake of your convenience. It's also for their convenience, and they have a stockpile, a wealth of data in their respective databases that they have access to, and it amounts to marketing data, and it's information that can be tied to people on the web.
Interestingly, Facebook actually, you know how you create a new account on Facebook, or if you have the option to find your friends by typing in various email accounts, Facebook actually recently removed Gmail from the list of email services that you can import from. And they also removed it from FriendFeed, which they purchased a while back, which is kind of an interesting move.
Yeah, I think it was the next step in this dispute, too. I think I might have read that myself. So after Gmail and Google started throwing up this PSA whenever the Gmail users attempted to manually import their their contacts out of Gmail, and they got redirected to that PSA. There was another story circulating that Facebook had started to even route around that PSA, which was being displayed before users were able to upload the file to Facebook. And then at some point during the last week or so, that's when Facebook completely removed the import your contacts from Gmail.
But isn't this sort of going against Google's own policy? Like, they said that we want to be open in, open out. Like, you can take your data and go. You can bring in new data. Google is very open with its data. Like, we're happy to help you export, import. And now that Facebook is like, well, we're happy to let you import, but we're not letting your data out ever, thanks. Google's like, well, we're not going to let you import to Facebook if it's never going to get out of there. Like, why are they changing their policy with regard to Facebook if they believe that openness is such a value? Isn't this just sort of an arms race that's now developing and, like, trade embargo sort of scenario where, oh, well, I'm not going to trade with you, you're not going to trade with me, and then everyone loses, especially the users?
That's exactly what it sounds like, and I think that's something that Mike Arrington was talking about when he says this is the era of data protectionism. So he referred to it as a double-bladed sword, in that in order to force companies to be more open, if you're going to lock down your own information, your own data, and not let it be portable, then it's just going to have the effect of making all the other organizations, all the other web service providers out there to lock down their data in turn, rather than opening up data to other people.
Ben, any thoughts on this story?
I think this falls into stuff that we're going to be seeing more and more as these tech companies become bigger and more sophisticated players in the market. And I think it kind of falls into the same line as the massive web of tech lawsuits that we're seeing, where previously people were standoffish and wanted to get along. As these companies are getting more power and more influence, they want people to start playing by their rules as opposed to playing by the rules that are best for everyone involved. I kind of throw up my hands and say, you know, that's the way it's going to be. But from a legal standpoint, yeah, I've been thinking about it. I don't think there's really anything that we can do other than be indignant and hope Google or Facebook changes their mind.
Yeah, these are basically data transactions, for lack of a better word, that are all governed by a terms of service agreement. That's where you'll find legal claims if they exist within those terms of service agreements. So if you're a user, the transaction is governed by the terms of service agreement between you and, say, Google or you and Facebook. And then with respect to the APIs, the way in which services or online web services can access each other's data, those are all probably governed by the API terms of service agreements. And so those will be a little bit different than the user agreements. And if there's going to be any claims, they're most likely going to be in, you know, either of those respective contracts. Because there aren't really, at this point, any statutory default rules or any codified bits of law that we can rely on in order to figure out the way in which this type of stuff should actually work. And, of course, this is still all, like, a very new area. The social web might be a little bit more mature than it was 5 years ago, but I think some people, especially lawyers, are still struggling to catch up to it.
Okay, any last thoughts before we move on to the next story? Dominic?
All set.
David?
All set.
Okay, then our next story is about a teenager from New York City who had a passion for electronics and a connection to somebody in the Foxconn factory out in China. So what this kid did is, through Foxconn, got a hold of the requisite parts, the front cover, back cover, and home button for white iPhones, and started selling them. He got them imported to the United States and then started selling them online as upgrade kits so that people could, on their own, upgrade their black iPhones to white iPhones. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was somewhere along the lines of $130 or $160 to just do the front, and then you can upgrade the back and the front for $200 somewhat. And I think there was also a kit for just the back cover. Anyway, the reason why this is the story is on this podcast is because the 17-year-old high school senior was contacted by a private investigator who apparently suggested that this teenager was selling stolen goods and made some sort of vague legal threat. I couldn't really find exactly what this threat was or really any more information about this private investigator who contacted him, But the tech media is implying that, you know, some Apple goon contacted this guy. A private investigator hired by Apple was the one who was making this threat. Any initial thoughts, Dominic or David?
It's worth noting that he went directly to the supplier Foxconn, and apparently knew a guy who knew a guy. And Foxconn is based in China, and apparently he just went through some sort of internal connection of people that he knew back in China and managed to get the parts that Apple had for the white iPhone that he purchased directly. It seems to be that they're the exact same parts that Apple would have used.
There has been a lot of talk about what has slowed down the delivery on the white iPhones, and I'm not really sure what the status is of all those rumors right now, or if there's an official line that Apple's saying. But do you guys know why there's no white iPhones yet?
Apple hasn't announced anything officially. The following things have been suggested: problems with the proximity sensor, problem with the front or rear cameras, light leaking into them, light leaking out of the case. And the other thing that was suggested was difficulty in getting a consistent white color across all of the phones.
And what I'm seeing here in the Gizmodo article about this too, was that I think, see, he made over $130,000, selling approximately 400 of these. It looks like the claim is that these are stolen parts somehow. It's interesting 'cause I don't know how it would, well, you've got an international aspect to this case, and I'm certainly no expert on international criminal matters, but yeah, I mean, this it could be a case of purchasing stolen goods. If these goods were stolen directly from Foxconn, the factory who was supposed to be selling these, I mean, it is a little curious to me how this ever would have gotten out in a way that was legal, especially if Apple had agreements with Foxconn or whatever company had manufactured these, and it was an exclusive agreement to be the provider of the white iPhone parts to it, and to exclusively provide them to Apple and no other person.
Right. So I guess the question for at least criminal liability here is whether or not the kid knew that the parts were stolen. My understanding is that he had a contact in Foxconn, was getting them through the guy. My guess is he was paying for them. But, you know, and if he was paying for them, I think he has a decent argument that he knew that they were, he didn't think they were stolen. The question, I guess, then is, you know, could a prosecutor or could Apple make a case to a judge or jury that the kid did know they were stolen? And perhaps a more interesting question for now is, does Apple have a trademark infringement claim against the kid? Because he's selling something in the United States with an Apple logo on the back, or at least the back conversion kit, so the full conversion kit, he'd be selling something with an Apple logo on it.
Well, it's not clear who's suing first. It just says a private
No one's
investigator from the
suing, yes.
story.
Right. And there was another story that I saw that was not sourced at all that said the Apple has called off the private investigator and is now handling the matter personally. But, you know, there was absolutely no supporting information on that, just hearsay. So, again, it seems unlike Apple to, first of all, hire a private investigator who then makes some vague threat, and then to continue to make vague threats, but in absolutely no official capacity.
Yeah, the interesting thing is how this enterprising 17-year-old actually reacted. You can go to his website. It's still up. It's whiteiphone4now.com. It looks decently professional. He's got logos of CNN, TechCrunch, various other companies. It doesn't look like something a 17-year-old perhaps would have put together. I mean, it's a little sketchy looking maybe if you look closely, but it looks decently legit. And, I mean, he got this threatening letter, and he didn't take his website down. He didn't panic. He was like, "No, I'll get my own lawyer and fight you," which is pretty ballsy for a 17-year-old.
Yeah, and for the
Yeah.
record, that's white iPhone the number 4 now. White iPhone 4 now.
Oh, both redirect actually. But looking at the site, it also looks like there's a notice on there that says we're stopping orders until the following Monday. I presume that means tomorrow, but.
I never understand what following Monday means. It's not consistently used. This is why we have dates on a calendar.
Yeah, I know. Well, maybe he meant to be vague, though, just to sort out the legal issues first, or the threats, or whatever was happening. Clearly something has spooked this person. Well, I shouldn't say clearly, but perhaps something has spooked him, and it is, in fact, a legal threat of some kind to stop selling the cases. But they do have up-close-and-personal shots of what the cases actually look like, and I don't own an iPhone 4, so I don't know how close some of the detail is on the cases to if it is like
it looks pretty much identical.
I mean, that might be some indication that these were authentically made by Foxconn, or whoever the provider was supposed to be of the white case, or if this could be a really good knockoff. It's kind of hard to tell.
I mean, it would have to be an exceptional knockoff. The front kit includes the screen, the back kit includes the camera, and if neither of those were authentic, I think it would become clear pretty early on that that was the case. I tried to bring this up earlier, but I don't think we really touched on it. Do we think that Apple would have a trademark infringement claim based on him selling the rear panels of these kits that has the Apple logo on it?
Yes.
Okay. If so, then why are they, one, waiting at all? And two, why would they, why would the initial threat have been that you're selling stolen goods, not that you're infringing Apple's trademark by selling something with the Apple trademark on it that isn't from Apple?
Like, it also has the iPhone word on the back, and it actually says, if you go to the website, you can see the close-up photos, designed by Apple in California, assembled in China, model A1132, which is what's on the back of my iPhone, EMC380A, all the FCC IDs, everything corresponds exactly. So this is not a knockoff. So I think Apple just might be biding their time in terms of why they're not bringing a trademark claim.
Yeah, it's possible that they could have tried to track this down on the back end to you know, determine how he might have gotten these parts in his hands, and maybe that process involves a private investigator, or maybe it involves somebody else, you know, going back to the folks in China who are manufacturing the parts and, you know, trying to figure out if there was some parts that were suddenly lost. Like, did you lose an entire lot of these things? Where did they go? How did they get into the, you know, somebody's hands where they were sold then to somebody in the U.S.? Or is this a case of the manufacturer directly offering these cases to, you know, the teenager? Those are all possibilities. I mean, you know, there's been other instances. For instance, I recall the SciStar case, where there was a lot of public speculation for almost a month and a half or so prior to any action actually by Apple. And in that case, it involved PCs that had the Mac OS X loaded onto them and were being sold online, and it was in violation of the EULA. So it was pretty apparent that there was a violation going on, but you know, there was a gap of time between when the tech media was talking about it and when Apple's attorneys actually acted upon that information.
Okay. Were you going to say something, Dominic?
Yeah, I was going to say basically what David did, that there's the business reason for waiting. Like, if a 17-year-old in New York can make this happen, pretty much anyone can make this happen, which means that there's some sort of leak in their supply line, something that needs to be fixed before they shut it down. And it's a lot easier to fix a leak if there's materials flowing through the leak, because then it's much easier to trace, because you can figure out where stuff is actually coming from. So by not shutting him down, they actually can figure out how he's getting these products, because I think it is the authentic parts, judging by the photos that like have the exact same number. It's either authentic parts or just an incredibly good knockoff. And if it's authentic parts, that's a huge problem for Apple, considering their culture of secrecy and control.
Okay. Any last thoughts before we move on? Dominic?
All set.
David?
Just another cautionary tale of being careful before you enter into business online, I suppose. I think he's worried about his future as a potential NYU computer science student, from what I read in the Gizmodo article, at least.
I mean, realistically, like, this is pretty awesome. like as a college, not even a college student, you set up something that, I mean, as long as he didn't do anything illegal, let's say that for the benefit of for we'll say that he thought he was working with someone legitimate, which is kind of hard to believe because there's no way these parts could be legitimate, but I mean, yeah, he's got some sort of future in business, hopefully, if he doesn't end up in jail.
You certainly found a gap in the marketplace.
Shall we move on to our next story? Or did you have any final thoughts, Ben?
I'm all set.
Okay. Our last story is an analysis of Google's algorithmic search results by Benjamin Edelman, whom I understand you know, Dave, so we might ask you about him in a bit. But basically, he did a rather exhaustive study of how Google changes the search results based on what you're searching for. A really easy way to test this is if you type in acne, A-C-N-E, into Google, you'll get one set of results, and if you type in acne with a comma directly after it, no space, you'll get the same set of results, but without the little Google Health prompt, I guess. I'm not entirely sure, reading this article, which is linked in our show notes, like his argument is basically Google is promoting its own services, and it's making them on top above all the search results. And this is true, they are. But they're not actually changing the search result themselves. They're just inserting this sort of helpful thing above their search results, right?
Yeah, I think that's one way of putting it, that it's clear for the vast majority of these that the first thing you see is a Google product. It's marked fairly clearly as it's Google, that it is Google, and it does not appear to look like other search results. It's not like the first thing that looks like a search result is Google. It's the first thing at the top of the page is Google's product.
Yeah, that seems to be the case mostly. So, I mean, his argument is that you can tell that there has been some, what he's calling here, a hard coding or hard coded change in the algorithm itself. And he said if we were just seeing the pure organic algorithmic results when you run a Google query, this is what it should look like. And what he's using as his basis is, and you can see the difference of when you search for a word like acne, and then when you search for a word with acne and then a comma right after it, because the hard coding doesn't include that term with the comma after it. And so supposedly what you're seeing is some sort of untouched result then, without anything that's hard-coded into it to be displayed at the top. The other interesting thing about this is that he notes that in some cases there are not, sort of like featured results, I don't know really what to call them. The results that are floating to the top are occasionally Google's preferred partners, and I don't really know what that means, but I'm going to suppose that it means there's some sort of agreement between Google and those companies, or maybe those companies purchase advertising from them. But in any event, it's not always very clear that what the relationship is, whether it's a financial relationship, whether this is meant to be more like a sponsored link that you would already see above all the organic results, the things that are definitely purchased by advertisers and the like.
He has a separate article on Google's actual advertisement labeling strategy, and it's not very consistent. So, and for someone who's not particularly technically skilled, it may look like Google is actually putting a search result in. Because if you're not really familiar with how Google works, you'd think the first result is the first result.
Yeah, the other half of this, I suppose, is that Google's company line has been for so many years is that we don't tamper with the results. We have our patented PageRank system. We have our own internal algorithm, which is an implementation of PageRank and a bunch of other things. Aside from tweaking the algorithm itself, we don't actually tweak the results as they're displayed. And he's pointing to this saying, well, that's not necessarily true. If you look at this, you can see that there are clearly things that are inserted in here, and this comma test is one way to see that, that are wouldn't otherwise be there if this was the pure results. And, I wonder, like, how much of this is necessarily a bad thing. I think I understand his point is that, look, Google can manipulate the search results, and when they do that, they might occasionally get their own products and services to float to the top, even though in a pure organic, query, they might actually appear further down on the page or maybe on the second or third page of Google results. And so maybe there's something awful about that that we don't want, but I really can't quite put my finger on it. I don't know that there's anything really in the proposition of a search engine which says that the results you're going to get displayed in front of you are neutral in some way. In fact, I think this is sort of like editorial judgment on the part of Google. Don't we want them also to be able to edit their own search results as they appear? This is how Google and the other search engines get around the issue of search engine optimization or people trying to game those organic Google results, right?
Right. One random quick bit of trivia about Google. PageRank is actually not named after a web page, it's actually named after Larry Page, one of the founders of Google. With that bit of trivia aside, though, like back in the early days of the web, I think like before Google even was around, there was, I don't want to say a big controversy because the web wasn't big, so it couldn't have been that big a controversy, but there were sites that were basically saying, if you give us money, we'll make your pages show up in our organic, quote unquote, search results with higher priority, and users won't be able to tell the difference. And people really frowned upon this because they were like, well, that's not, and users should be able to know when something has been bought and paid for, or whether it's just the actual results of what's best out on the web using your particular algorithm. But there were a couple sites that actually advertised themselves as we will show advertised, we will show people who've given us money, their websites will be higher in the hits than people who have not given us money, and they tried to incentivize people to give them money by means of this.
I think this still goes on today too. So I think probably all of us here have landed on a link farm at one point in our lives or another. I mean, in the last couple of years, maybe even the last couple of weeks, when you throw in a Google query, all of a sudden you think you have a relevant result somewhere in your organic list. You click on it and you go to it, and it's just a page full of links. And like, it looks like it's its own search engine. You click through on some of the links, maybe if you try to, or maybe at your own peril. And you might never get to the content that you're looking for. And as I understand it, at least part of the way that PageRank works, and I'm probably going to give a poor explanation of this, is that it's essentially ranking all the results based on pages that link to one page, and it sort of uses the number of times a page is linked to, and it has a weighting process and determining which page is linked to which other pages in order to determine sort of a hierarchy of what results are most relevant for certain topics and certain search terms. And because of that, that's one reason why we might have these link farms that still exist. These are people who are trying to game the search engine results by linking out as many times as possible. It's also one of the reasons that we have a lot of spam on blogs and stuff like that, where you get sometimes comments posted or comments that are on a post that are nothing more than a series of links.
Yeah, but I guess the greater point I was trying to make is all those websites that meddled with their search results failed when Google came around. Like, Google basically totally dominated the market. And initially, they didn't meddle with their search results at all. Like, initially, Google didn't even have ads.
Yeah, it's curious. I can't speak for the success of any search engine optimization attempts these days, but I think there are still some people out there who say it makes a difference, and there are tons of articles on it. But there are also people like Robert Scoble, who says that search engine optimization is entirely dead, and we're now moving into an era, or we have already moved into an era, that is more about quality of content. I don't know what the actual answer is to that.
I mean, that's just not true. I mean, there's still many, many, many companies who have SEO experts on staff or hire out SEO to other companies. It's he may like to think that that is the case, but it is not currently the case.
Yeah, and there's a fine line to determining, if that is actually ever the case, because there will always be companies out there who try to sell you on, we'll be able to get you higher in the Google results. But anyway, I think the bigger point is that there are still reasons why Google might want to maintain some sort of editorial judgment over what shows up in its organic results. And if they're able to determine that people are utilizing things to game the organic results in a way that's unfair, or whatever Google thinks of internally as being bad for the whole search process, then they should be able to remove that. And there's always two sides to this argument, but I mean, it's not surprising to me that Google products pop up on top, and that people that have paid for certain things have their products also appear on the top of the organics list.
Is there something wrong with Google making it easier for users to say if you type in a stock quote, they'll show you a chart that links to Google Finance, and then they'll show you the rest of the results?
I don't particularly have a problem with it because that's probably what I'm looking for. I don't really care who's giving me what the stock quote is, as long as the first thing that I see is the stock quote and I don't have to click through to see it. I think the issue comes when Google has repeatedly and repeatedly and repeatedly said that they don't hard code anything into their search results, that all of their search results are organic, and the article notes that sometimes they do say that and sometimes they don't say that, but I think it's still fair to say that, you know, these search results are separate and apart from the what we take as the Google organic search results, so they may not be violating their own rules by doing it.
Yeah, so there, like we've sort of been talking about here, there is it the fact that Google is hard coding certain results to search queries, or is it the fact that they tell people that they don't manipulate the algorithmic results? I think that's the ultimate question. You know, articles like these sort of illustrate that there's an empirical way that you could go about bringing up the tampering, or you could actually see it. But I think it's also a little disingenuous to the people at Google. It would surprise me that someone might not think to include as part of a hard-coded search query result something that just had a comma after it, or a period after it, or something else that seems relatively minor, or a minor alteration to a search query.
Yeah, I think, I mean, to play devil's advocate a little bit, Google isn't changing their search results, but when they put in stuff like a stock chart or whatever for a stock symbol, they're certainly changing what the user sees, but the search results are still there and unchanged. They're just adding stuff that isn't, quote unquote, a search result.
Yeah,
Does
on
that
that
make sense?
note, it does. And I just did a search for this, the acne and acne comma search. And with acne comma, you at least when I just did it, I got three ads. With acne, I get two ads, and then the Google Health, which, again, it does stand apart because it's clearly not an organic search result, but it's not as separated as I was initially saying. It does to some degree look like look like a search result, but it's got a little ad, a little image next to it, and it's set apart, and it's got a line of links underneath it to Google Health, Mayo Clinic, Medline Plus, and WebMD.
Yeah, it's worth noting that Google doesn't just link to its own services, they also link to others. You see the same thing with stock quotes. You could get linked to Yahoo Finance, or with flight information, you'll get linked to Expedia and other companies as well.
But if you click on the word acne or the image, it will take you to Google Health. But
Correct.
those other links are available.
And in some sense, users expect that, right? They're at google.com. It's not like they went to yahoo.com, but they went to google.com. So they have already indicated a preference for receiving Google services. So,
Well, that's where the problem is, at least to some people. Search engines play such a critical role in a user's interaction with all of the content that's available on the internet. Basically, it would be impossible for a person to be able to navigate the internet without something like a search engine. And because so much traffic is routed directly to Google, and it's not so much routing as it is, I guess, personal choice. Your home, maybe your home page is a Google page. Maybe you decide that Google is your search engine of choice. In either case, you're making a choice to go to Google.com and do the searches there. But how much of that is just out of habit, and how much of that is actual preference? There's, you know, something like 74 or 5% of searches that are conducted from U.S. Internet users are Google searches, and the other 25% of that or so goes, you know, to the other internet search engines. But people are worried that there's such a concentration of internet users that just go to Google, when some people say that these days that the search engines really aren't that much, at least between Bing and Google, they seem to provide very similar results, so they're not that much different from each other, in terms of what you get when you search. So has search become more like a public utility of some kind? Is this like the telecom era of the 1970s, where the way that you would access hard phone lines, the twisted pair as it were, that you only had one or two choices in your area and you had to go through AT&T, and it became so obscene that the government had to step in and heavily regulate it and break up the large telecom companies like AT&T into regional Bell operating offices and the like? Is that something that might be the future for Google? It's way too early to tell, and I think there were a lot of people out there who just say, let's just wait and see what happens before we start going all gung-ho and creating new federal search commission-like agencies and stuff. But, I guess at the same time, it's important that people are watching this and aware of the fact that Google can so easily sort of take you off of its first page results list, and maybe if you're an e-commerce retailer or something, that might be, the end of your business.
All right, any other thoughts on this story?
I'm all set.
I think I'm good.
Right, well, thank you for listening to this podcast. Please visit us at technicallylegal.org or follow us on Twitter at @techlegal. If you have any thoughts, commentary, or just want to tell us how wonderful we are, feel free to email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Thanks again. I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm Ben Snitkov.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Have a wonderful week.